Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Governor Cooper declares a state of emergency and hits the road to encourage voters to lobby legislators to stop moves he sees as weakening public education. Interim CMS Superintendent Crystal Hill is named to the post permanently, even as the school board encounters opposition from parents to their latest boundary plans. Another sexual assault on a CMS school bus and a student prank at Mallard Creek High that goes wrong, plus tempers flare on city council over what most consider the settled issue, elements of the Unified Development Ordinance, and Katz fires a driver who returns passenger gunfire on a bus and puts their chief of rail operations on administrative leave. Here to discuss those stories and more is WCNC education reporter Shamaria Morrison. Welcome back.
Good morning. I seem like I've been here all month.
Well, you probably have. We'll have to start paying you. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Mike.
Nick Oxner is chief investigative reporter for WBTV. Welcome to you.
Hello and happy Friday.
And for the first time, everybody applaud. We welcome Jenna Contino. She's a reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Jenna, thank you for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
It's time to declare a state of emergency for public education in North Carolina.
The opening words of a statement the governor made this week as he launched another road trip to convince voters there is reason for alarm over moves in the legislature that he believes could have damaging consequences for our public schools.
It's clear that the Republican legislature is aiming to choke the life out of public education. I'm declaring this state of emergency because you need to know what's happening. If you care about public schools in North Carolina, it's time to take immediate action and tell them to stop the damage that will set back our schools for a generation.
Okay, Shamaria, set us up. What's he talking about?
A mix of things. And so I think the most direct thing he's talking about is the most recent budgets that have come out from both the House and the Senate and what those look like in comparison to his suggestions. I can just let you know they are thousands of dollars apart. In addition to Republican-backed efforts to continue to increase funding for private school vouchers, in addition, there are a number of charter school bills that are also going through the General Assembly that would change a lot of power in charter schools. And so you just see over and over and over again, the General Assembly, Republican-led, you see his office, Democratic-led, just having a complete opposite feel of where the education should be going in North Carolina, two opposite ends of the spectrum.
We've been talking for a couple of weeks now about the expansion of these opportunity scholarships to everyone and essentially funding individual students over school systems. They can take the money with them wherever they go. And they would provide up to $7,000 a year to be put toward a private education, which everybody knows that won't even pay the first semester of a private education in most cases. But nonetheless, that's what they want to do. And I'm just curious if any other state in the union does this.
I don't know if they do it to that amount, but you do have other states. I can't tell you the one specifically, but I have read reports, a lot of them coming from NPR themselves, talking about the expansion of private schools. There have been some court cases that allow for such things, and that's how we've come to this moment where you can put public dollars in private school vouchers to go to these private schools. So this is a big topic nationwide, and it is happening in other places. To this extent of North Carolina, I can't say right now to you, but private school education being funded by public dollars is happening.
So they still haven't passed the bill yet, but every single Republican in the House and Senate are in favor of these opportunity scholarships and the expansion of them. So that is why the governor has launched this road trip. It's really the only tool he has in the face of a supermajority that will inevitably override any veto that he signs, correct? So do these road trips make a difference? Can they make a difference?
I mean, it's the power of the pulpit, and I know Nick has probably something he wants to say about how much this actually is going to be helpful. In my opinion, it'll be helpful to the people who maybe voted for him. Other folks, I don't know how much. He's convincing.
What I see this as is an extension of what we saw the governor do a couple of weeks ago in the face of the abortion restrictions that the Republicans passed in the General Assembly. We saw the governor do a similar kind of road trip, bully pulpit, did some rallies in Raleigh, and that was largely successful from a comms and PR point of view. It obviously didn't change the outcome of that bill. But here we have, again, another set of legislation, and interestingly, pushed by Representative Tricia Cotham, now Republican of Mecklenburg County, is leading the way on the opportunity vouchers. And so, you know, what I see is this is an extension. The abortion stuff went well from a momentum and PR and marketing standpoint, and this is much the same play, especially with the clever idea of calling a state of emergency, and I'm using air quotes because even the governor acknowledges this is not an actual state of emergency.
One of the great concerns here, because this would be something new that nobody really knows how it would turn out, and you don't know how much money would be diverted from public schools until you discover how many students want to take advantage of this, but there could be an enormous impact in terms of the money going to public education, and some see this as a blatant, bald-faced attempt to destroy public education. And the money would be taxpayer money that would go to private schools that have no accountability, that don't have to take everybody, that can discriminate, that don't have to provide transportation, that don't have to provide school lunches, that don't have to take care of special interests or special needs children, and yet it's taxpayer money. And the big thing that we talked about on Wednesday was the fact that they are held to no particular standards. There's no accountability. If taxpayer money is going to fund these in great extent, shouldn't they be held to the same standards as public schools? Is that something that's being floated around in the zeitgeist?
It is being discussed, but not in that vein. So Republicans who are backing this say the ultimate person who you are accountable to when it comes to education of students is the parents. And if these students or these schools are not doing right by the parents, well, they'll just take them out. And so they are using the guise of, you know, parents are who are responsible. And if they feel like they're not doing right, they're not doing right. And the ultimate thing that they're saying is, well, you don't have to go to these private schools. You can stay at public school. So it's not like we're forcing you by your hand to be dragged to these schools that you feel have no accountability. It's really up to you. But they say that they don't want to limit the choices of these parents at the same time.
How concerned is CMS and or other districts around the area should this happen? Because they will lose money in this. And then some of the parents who are on the lower income spectrum will take that $7,000 expecting to get into Charlotte Country Day or some other school and discover that's not going to be able to happen. So they'll be still in the public schools. What will that mean?
They are concerned, absolutely, because anything that kind of pulls resources in any amount, whether it be resources that are monetary, land, all of these things are important to Charlotte Mecklenburg schools. So for every private school that might come up here, well, that's less land for a CMS school to build on. They continue to expand. They're trying to ask taxpayers for money to build new schools. But also when it comes to the education front of things, right, when you have lawmakers who are taking money, despite if that money is not directly coming from quote unquote education funds at this moment, still money is finite. And at some point, maybe that money could have went to public, general public schools or traditional public schools in some sense, but it's not going. So they're worried.
So the governor launched this tour, and he came to Charlotte this week on this tour to get people to talk to their legislators about his concerns over public education. And a lot of what he said was pretty pointed. North Carolina U.S. Senator Tom Tillis, a Republican, of course, had this to say about the governor's statement and his tour. He said, quote, through his partisan temper tantrums, it's clear that Roy Cooper isn't handling being a lame duck governor very well. Governor Cooper created a phony state of emergency in a desperate attempt to block bipartisan, fiscally responsible legislation that will cut taxes for hardworking families, provide pay raises for teachers, more educational opportunities for students, and fund Medicaid expansion. Is any or all of that correct?
depends on who you're asking. You can have the same statement, and depending on who you're asking, it means two totally different things. I'll talk about the teacher raises, for example. Yes, teachers are getting raises per se with the Senate and the House's version of teacher pay raises, but are they getting a lot? And so technically the statement is true, but when you kind of look into it, there's nuance that's a lot of times it's missing when politics are talking. And I'm even talking about Roy Cooper as well. You know, there is some nuance missing from his side of the conversation as well. You know, we talk about what this is happening, what this is doing to public schools, but there are legit parents who are done with the public school system when it comes to, let's say, for example, student discipline, right? We know that Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools has a very big problem with the disproportionate amount of Black and Brown students that they are suspending. And I'm not saying that charter schools or public or private schools don't also have that same problem, but I don't think we can ignore that there are problems in public schools that some parents are saying, wait, I don't have enough time for you all to figure it out because we've given you decades or we've given you years to do so.
Well, this week, and it happened just after this program ended, I think last Friday, the Charlotte Mecklenburg School Board named their new permanent school superintendent. And lo and behold, it turns out to be interim school superintendent Crystal Hill. The school board narrowed the field down, I think, from 39 candidates, 19 of whom were superintendents, down to 6. And she ended up being named. So was the national search pro forma?
I asked that question. I particularly said, how do you think taxpayers feel of you being a good steward of their money with you all picking someone internally inside? Their response was, it was a good thing that we did it nationally, and that's because we could see how she lined up against other candidates and she came out on top. And so this wasn't a thing where we just picked her. It was because that she stood up against those other candidates strongly and she came out on top. So
she came out on top for 66% of the school board because the vote was 6-3. So that means that 3 of them did not see her as the top choice. What does that tell you?
Well, Anne asked that question, actually, and their response to her was, it was simply a difference of opinion, not of the quality of candidate. And so you had one person of the old board, I like to say, and another person of the new board. So Jennifer Delahara, who's an at-large member, she did not vote to have her be superintendent. And then you had two of those new members who were just recently elected last year, who also said, we actually do not want, including Summer Nunn, who was the board chair, and that was very telling and very surprising in a sense.
Yeah, we should say, Mike, this just doesn't happen. Like, you don't see split votes like this on a vote this consequential. And even in previous superintendent votes, Ann and I were talking about this, when you've seen that maybe behind the scenes there was some internal dissent, when you knew that where the direction was going to go, everyone would come out and support and you'd get a unanimous vote for your new district leader. So very telling.
They were saying a statement without saying a statement, no matter what they were saying to us in public. Your vote speaks volumes.
Well, given the recent and distant history of school board superintendents in Charlotte, wouldn't it seem to be wise on the part of the school board if they took this 6-3 vote to then amend the vote so that it could be unanimous, given the history of what's been happening here recently?
It's also clear they knew what the vote count was. I mean, whether or not that's legal, I'm talking with my lawyers about. But Crystal Hill said that she talked to the people who were going to vote against her before the vote. And so everyone knew what the vote was. She said that in the press conference on Friday. So everyone knew what the vote was going to be, and they did it anyways. Again, which is why this is so significant in terms of optics.
And you pointed out, Shamaria, that the chair of the search committee voted no, which I think is interesting. One of Crystal Hill's fans, however, is Mecklenburg County Commissioner Mark Jarrell, who was impressed with her before she was named to the job.
She answered questions. I felt like her staff was well prepared. From my time being on the board, that was probably, in my opinion, the most prepared I've seen CMS staff coming before us.
So when we come back, we'll find out if his opinion is shared by others and how many others, and talk a little bit more about this new superintendent coming in and some of the trials and tribulations she will face in the short and long term. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins, the local news roundup featuring Shamaria Morrison from WCNC-TV, where she is their education reporter. Nick Oxner is WBTV's chief investigative reporter. Joe Bruno is here from Channel 9, WSOC-TV. And Jenna Contino is waiting in the on-deck circle. She's a reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We just heard Mark Jarrell, a county commissioner, say very favorable things about Crystal Hill and how impressed she was about her and her staff while she was interim superintendent, being among the most prepared in terms of presenting things to county commission that he's ever experienced. What have others in the community had to say about her appointment?
Well, previous to this, she was at Cabarrus County Schools, and you saw in comments of multiple news outlets, folks underneath there saying who've worked there, talking about how much of a loss it was to Cabarrus County when she was there. At least some of them saying in regards
when she left,
and the reason being because they were talking about how she was able to help with some of the achievement gap problems there in Cabarrus County. But when you come to people talking about what she's done here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, you talked about Mark Jarrell, also folks like Dina DiOrio, who is the, you know, the county manager as well, talking about what kind of strong leader she is. And so those are some of the highlights that people have said about Crystal Hill and her coming in, being very strong and with a central office, moving people around to, you know, really come in and take control of the situation, no matter if she was just going to be there as interim. They said it was a really good transition with her. So
before we move on, CMS forced out the last three superintendents less than 3 years into their tenure of hiring them, and also in some cases after renewing their contracts and giving them bonuses. Most, if not all, of those people left shrouded in mystery with hefty payouts. What's her deal?
So one of the things that were very interesting about her deal is that she will not get what someone like Ernest Winston got, where he was able to get thousands of dollars from taxpayers after he left. She has a 90-day clause. So if she does get fired without cause, which is a legal term, but let's just say she gets fired and they don't give a reason, she'll get paid just for 90 days as opposed to a full 2 years like Ernest Winston was. And Nick, have you kind of looked through it too and saw any of those things that really stuck out to you as far as things that were different from some of those other contracts?
Yeah, well, that was interesting to me. I looked and saw $300,000 for 4 years. So that's more money than Ernest Winston is making. It's, you know, 4 years is a long time. And then, yeah, you get down to the 90 days. I mean, Winston walked away with more than $500,000 for doing nothing for this school year and next school year. And then you see the 90 days, and it might be the first time I've seen Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools learn its lesson.
So before we talk about some of the challenges that Hill will face, let's talk about the recent revelation that the United States Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights is investigating CMS's handling of sexual harassment cases. This falls under possible Title IX violations, and Dr. Hill was in charge of overseeing Title IX during part of her tenure here. But Nick, was she in that position during the time that any of these possible violations that are being investigated occurred?
Yeah, so this investigation was opened in November of last year. The existence of the investigation is just now coming to light, and it's not clear there are so many things to choose from, unfortunately, but it's not clear what the actual incident or the facts surrounding the investigation. That's not public, and I've not been able to glean that yet. Dr. Hill got on the CMS payroll last May of 2022 as the chief of staff, in which Title IX improvements were in her portfolio. So yeah, she was at CMS when this investigation was opened, but we don't know what the incident is. So I don't know definitively.
So we don't know what they're investigating.
Correct.
Okay. As you reported on WBTV last January, Dr. Hill detailed the efforts the district had undertaken to improve its handling of reported sexual violence at CMS on their campuses. Have those measures been effective?
I think by any measure, no, because we're still doing multiple stories, three stories in 3 months, about students being reportedly sexually assaulted. All three of these this year have been on school buses, and school administrators not calling police like they're supposed to and not completing the Title IX paperwork. And more importantly, Mike, in January, Dr. Hill told me that parents shouldn't have to call the news for to handle issues with their children's Title IX complaints. And yet, again, that's what three more mothers have had to do in order to get any action from the school district.
And recently you reported on a couple of sexual assault allegations on buses, which appear to have been bungled by the schools. And now another one just came to light, I believe it was this week. This time it was the mother of a 13-year-old girl at Turning Point Academy. She called WBTV for help after reporting being sexually assaulted on a school bus. Was it the child that called WBTV or her mother?
Her mother called. Her mother called after learning about this 10 days after the fact.
You spoke with the mother, LaTonja Whitaker, who said she didn't find out about this until, as you just said, 10 days after it allegedly occurred.
I received a call about a week ago from CMS schools saying that my daughter was sexually assaulted on a CMS school bus. She said that they was punching on her, they was choking her, and they was holding her down by her arms and her legs. And, you know, just touching her and her privacy.
Why didn't her daughter tell her mother that this had happened?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know that, but it's also not unusual. We know this, that it's not unusual for people who've experienced things like that to not even report to law enforcement, report to friends or family. What is notable in this case, Mike, is that the incident was reported by three other students, according to the school's own paperwork, who told a guidance counselor what they had seen. And that's how administrators learned about it the day after it happened.
So the schools knew about it. And after the mother was informed of this, she filed a report with CMPD and says an officer came to her house but did not fill out a police report. Why not?
That also is a question that remains to be answered. The police said there was a bit of miscommunication. They thought she was going to call back because it took them 5 or 6 hours to get out to her house after she called. It was late at night. But then the mom heard from the school resource officer assigned to Turning Point the very next morning. And ultimately, no report was filed. An investigation did not begin until I called CMPD to ask why no report had been taken.
And CMPD Lieutenant Kevin Pietras, I think that's how you say his name, acknowledged the delay in opening the investigation when you spoke with him, and he said it stemmed from multiple factors in and outside their control.
What we would say is, hey, as law enforcement, we want to be notified right away. We want to be able to talk to witnesses. We want to be able to respond to the scene. We want to be able to maybe collect physical evidence.
So the girl was 13. It happened on a school bus. What, if anything, do we know about the alleged perpetrators?
We don't know any specific details, and arguably that stuff is all protected by confidentiality laws from the school. What we do know, Mike, is that that bus had both middle school students, like the girl was, and high school students. Mm-hmm. Turning Point Academy is the alternative school for students with behavioral difficulties and other challenges. And so they could range in age from middle school into high schoolers.
So the mother, LaTonja Whitaker, has given CMS a vote of no confidence when it comes to protecting children.
No, I don't think any child is safe in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. As long as they have the administrators that they have in office now, I don't think any student is.
Those are damning words. And so once again, you emailed then interim superintendent Crystal Hill asking for an interview. You've had some testy exchanges in the past. I think she walked out on one interview you did with her. What response, if any, did you receive?
Nothing. And that's not an exaggeration. No response from her. Dr. Hill continues to not answer questions in the face of these specific incidents. And again, she, on Friday at her introductory press conference Friday of last week, for the first time, she said the most substantive things in response, and that is that there would be accountability for administrators who mishandle these things. Because again, in this Turning Point case, they didn't call police, they didn't call the parent, and they didn't fill out any paperwork. So they did nothing. But there has yet to be literally any accountability for any of these situations. So we have yet to follow up with Dr. Hill to ask what she means by that.
And I may have the details of this a little fuzzy, but as I understand it, you then attended a recent school board meeting where seven members of the board stood silent in a room and refused to answer your questions about why CMS continues to mishandle reported sexual assaults. The only member of the board to speak was Vice Chairwoman Stephanie Sneed.
I think we have a responsibility to be responsive to parents, and I think that we will be in the capacity that we can.
What does that mean, and do you believe they will follow through?
I honestly don't know what that means. That is the first real words we've heard from a school board member on this subject. And so I give Ms. Sneed credit for saying something. I don't frankly know what that means, but something, as her colleagues, minutes after her colleagues sat there and either ran away from my questions or smirked at me, or like Jennifer Dale Hara took out her cell phone and recorded me trying to ask her questions that she would not answer. You can watch the whole thing online. I encourage you to, if you like accountability from your school board, and see that there is none here. I don't know what that means. I give her credit for saying something. But until we have a cultural change where the board feels like this is not acceptable, this is going to continue happening, Mike. I've been reporting on this nonstop for 2 years now.
Right. Well, one of the challenges facing the new superintendent is the changing of some school boundaries to accommodate growth and new schools coming online to accommodate that growth. They've had a couple of meetings to go over the plans. They've revised those plans, and it looks like they may be doing that again as the result of a meeting on Wednesday. A huge crowd carrying signs turned out, and for 3.5 hours, the board heard from many of them. Some approved of the latest plan.
We support the superintendent's recommendation as is.
Others expressed key concerns.
Our top priority is home to school distance.
And while others had a decidedly dim view.
It's hard to see the haphazard lines that hopscotch over major roads like Gray and Colony as anything other than a gerrymandered map.
So overall, Shamaria, what was the sentiment in the room?
Oh my gosh, the sentiment in the room was that we are very upset. We are very angry. There was crying, there was yelling, there was, we'll see you in November's. This is a very, very, very heated topic. CMS has admitted themselves that they really don't feel like they have a good comprehensive review of these boundaries when it comes to the district as a whole. And this is kind of a new thing, how they're approaching this. And so I'll tell you some of the biggest problems with some parents. Some of it was, so that this conversation has been going on for months, but some parents, when there was a first draft, a second draft, and this final draft, people who were in the first draft, well, they had time to kind of advocate for what they would like to happen to their schools. But imagine the folks in the third draft who only learned about that a week ago. They didn't have time to advocate because the superintendent's recommendation was just that, the recommendation. And so now we're going to see in a June meeting if the school board is going to say, hey, we need you all to go back to the board. Like, there are some instances where kids are going miles away from a school to go to, let's say, middle school. And it's, and like they have a local middle school that's like 2 feet away from them and stuff like that. So some of it feels like it doesn't make sense. But there's like a, this bigger thing where you have to make sure this works for everyone. And there will be some people that just will not be accommodated because that's just the way that these boundaries and these feeder pattern conversations work out right now.
In fairness, this is a gigantic puzzle that has to be put together. But this plan was designed while Crystal Hill was interim superintendent, and one she recommended prior to getting the job full time. We commented on this last week that they had just last week, prior to her being named superintendent, they approved the plan. And I commented at the time, isn't it odd that we don't have a superintendent, we haven't waited for that new person to come in, and yet they've approved this plan, which was a red flag, not a red flag, but it was an indication that perhaps she was going to get the job, and she did get the job. And parents and students are always emotional when you're talking about assigning schools or reassigning schools. Is this another instance of that, or does this put Dr. Hill in a bad light?
I don't think it puts her in a bad light. I think it is just such a great way to show how much she has to go into with CMS and some of the things. Like, she has a big kind of, I don't want to say cloud over her shoulder, but a big responsibility over her shoulder coming into this. And one, you know, people are already questioning, oh, she was interim and now she's the superintendent now. So despite whatever qualification she may have, that's just going to be the cloud that's over her head of, well, you make sure you have to produce because we want you to prove that you deserve this spot, which eventually eventually she will or she won't. But also you're going to have all these other issues. And I think that she's just coming in at a time where there are a lot of change in CMS, a lot of criticism of the district. And to put that on her shoulders is a big responsibility, but she's also getting paid $300,000 for it. So, you know, the money speaks for itself.
At one point, Superintendent Hill said this was going to be her final recommendation, but school board member Jennifer De La Jara appears to be pushing the board in a different direction.
I think we may need to look at some alternate, and we can get into the details of that a little bit later.
And the crowd goes wild. So what happens now, and what are the final steps?
All right. So at their June 6th meeting, the board will have a vote and they can say, hey, we will keep this recommendation, we'll modify this recommendation, or we will reject it. But here are the things or the consequences of that. There are students right now who do not know what their next high school will be. That means they haven't done classes yet. There are students, because they don't know what their next, you know, middle school or whatever is going to be, they also have not gone into sports. And some of this stuff starts now. And so can you imagine these juniors or these seniors and these sophomores not knowing what they're going to be doing? And so delaying this vote does have real world consequences when you have both a middle school and a high school relief that's going to be opening up in the next school year. Well, at least the high school is. The middle school is a little bit further down the road. But
so one more school story before we move on. Mallard Creek High School was the site of a student prank gone wrong. About 50 students, and oddly enough, the school principal who gave them the keys to the building are involved in all of this. Joe, what happened?
Well, I don't know if it's TikTok. I don't know what the trend is, but it seems like the senior pranks this year are a little more vandalism than normal. We've seen it in several school districts, several different schools where kids are going too far, and they are not just playing innocent pranks on their administrators. They are actually causing vandalism and destruction of property. And that is what we saw here in Mallard Creek.
The students caused thousands of dollars in damage, and they now face serious consequences. Some of them will be, if they're tried, that we tried as adults, and because they're facing criminal charges here in many cases. CMPD Sergeant J.D. Williams says charges range from misdemeanors to vandalism and could be harmful to these perpetrators in other ways.
As parents, we need to be intentional about keeping track of our children and what they're doing. This foolish prank could not only result in some of these kids not being allowed to participate in a milestone moment in graduating with their peers, but colleges and employers can pull these records, and it could end up preventing them from future opportunities.
So I have about 20 seconds, Joe. It was reported in some news outlets that they had broken in, but I also read that the principal had given them the keys to the building. What's the story?
What I heard was that a window was unopened, and it was an elaborate plan by the students to sneak through this window and then stay quiet for like an hour, and then they went on their spree.
Okay. Well, we'll stay tuned to that, see what happens in that situation. When we come back, we'll talk about tempers flaring at City Council and many other things on the local news roundup. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Shamaria Morrison is here from WCNC-TV. She's their education reporter. Joe Bruno is with us from WSOC-TV. Nick Oxner is here with WBTV. And Jenna Contino, reporter for the Charlotte Observer, also with us this morning. City Council held a contentious meeting this week filled with accusations of racism and working in bad faith. They voted 6-5 to revisit a rule that allows duplexes and triplexes to be built in single-family neighborhoods. Joe, you were there. Why are we rehashing this? I thought this was all settled by the UDO.
We are days away from the UDO going into effect, and more community members are starting to realize some of the aspects of the UDO that maybe they weren't paying attention to or wasn't top of mind when this debate went on for 3 years, particularly around buy right development. I think of a townhome proposal in Mallard Creek where the developer openly was saying, if you deny this, we can still build 116 townhomes after June 1st. And we don't have to give you a pool. We don't have to give you a buffer. We don't have to give you all of these other concessions, a brick facade.
So really, you can approve this, our rezoning petition that puts in these protections in place, or we'll just wait till June 1 and build it by right.
So, Jenna, is this because they're getting cold feet on putting these new restrictions in, or is it because these restrictions were voted in by a previous council and the new council may not be on the same page?
Yeah, I will make a note that Councilman James Mitchell, who made the motion, was not on the previous council that passed the UDO. So I don't want to speak for him or say his intention with that, but it definitely does raise some questions. Just like Joe was saying, just a few days before this kind of guidebook for development in Charlotte is set to go into effect. But on the counterpoint, one of these buzzwords we saw ahead of the UDO being passed by council was, oh, it's this living, breathing document. It can constantly change. So is it changing before it even goes into effect? Who knows?
I guess that means that the previous council does not have the heft of the founding fathers. We don't have to take them literally. As you mentioned, James Mitchell made this suggestion that set the fire at city council. Mayor Pro Tem Braxton Winston was sharply critical of the decision to revisit duplexes and triplexes, that the thing that James Mitchell asked for.
This is an attempt to try to re-implement exclusionary zoning to the UDO. It is an attempt to preserve the tool, the number one tool that not just here in Charlotte, but in North Carolina and all over this country that has been used to segregate communities. I do not want to use the tools of the oppressor. I want to use the equity lens.
When Winston believes single-family zoning promotes segregation, and he tried to shame his colleagues for considering even making such a change.
The same thing happens everywhere. Everybody's, oh, I'm not against housing affordability, but just don't put it near me. Put it over there. It's not that we don't like those people. I just don't want them near me. It is ridiculous. Ridiculous that this motion was made, and you guys should be ashamed of yourselves if you vote this in.
Well, Councilwoman Victoria Watling, who is Black, wasn't having it.
I call BS on everything that Mr. Winston just said. You're not going to tell me that this is an equity lens when the only people that are affected live in the most vulnerable neighborhoods. This is not about NIMBYism. The people who don't want you in their neighborhood have HOAs.
Mm-hmm. She was referring to a city map showing which neighborhoods have homeowners associations and which do not. Most neighborhoods in affluent areas have them, which means they could pass their own rules to prohibit denser housing, regardless of what the city does. And she says people likely to be most impacted by duplexes and triplexes replacing single-family homes are in lower-income Black neighborhoods.
So for you to sit here in my face and tell me that you're ashamed because I'm voting against something that I think is disproportionately impacting Black people negatively, too bad, because I'm not stupid.
And Council's Renee Johnson, who is also Black, agreed.
This is not blatant racism. There is a place for single-family subdivisions, period. You can have strategic development, and that's what we are asking for. There are places, there are urban areas where duplexes and triplexes are appropriate, but implanted in single-family subdivisions is not appropriate. We cannot just plop down development and pray that it works.
The tenor of the conversations being had on Charlotte City Council are not like they were in the good old days. What is going on here? I mean, this got really heated and emotional.
I mean, I think this is something we're seeing a lot with the new, and I don't know, Joe, maybe you disagree with me, but with the new city council committee schedule, I feel like there's a lot of confusion over what certain city council members can change in committee and then what goes to council. And that's just kind of produced this kind of, and I don't know if animosity is too strong a word, but definitely tensions over whether the work happens in committee, whether it happens on the council, that I've kind of seen slowly building up. But this was a heated argument. This argument goes back to, like you said, the last council. And I definitely do I see both sides, and where Braxton Winston is coming from, the history of single family zoning has a lot of racism in it. I mean, we know with redlining and you know, exclusionary covenants in HOAs. So there is a lot of pain there. So I think that's definitely understandable coming from him in that response. And that's a lot of the arguments we saw early on last year being rehashed.
Shamara, I think you wanted to jump in here.
I did. And I think that conversations like that are important to have out in the public, because what you saw previous to this is conversation that were important like this that used to happen in the background, right? And so you have these politicians who are now saying that was the old way. It didn't work. We need to be having these conversations, these arguments, arguments, I say that lightly, but in person. And this is good for democracy. This is good for taxpayers. I want to hear these things out loud and not in back rooms. And I think it's telling of the people who are being voted to these positions, because you have to remember these folks who are outspoken, what were they doing before? A lot of them were community advocates. A lot of them were doing different things, and they weren't what you would say the age-old politicians who were doing things in back rooms. They believe that sunshine happens in the light, and I appreciate it.
Joe and Jenna, Joe first, go ahead.
Wholeheartedly agree with everything you just said. It's messy, but it's much appreciated for people to see this work happen in front of their faces. I think a little bit of the tension and maybe heat in that meeting came from the fact that they started that meeting at 3:30 and that debate was happening at 10 o'clock. And I believe the meeting even went on until after midnight, because they had a closed session after the public. So maybe that was a little bit on themselves for loading their schedule like that. I get sick of people when I'm with them for more than 5 hours, so I can't imagine how they were feeling.
Jenna.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I've worked at small newsrooms in South Carolina where everything happens behind the scenes and they do a unanimous vote. And I would much prefer to kind of see the behind the scenes. And I think that's more beneficial for the taxpayers and for the people who voted these people into office. So
Malcolm Graham on city council is a UDO supporter. I guess we should back up and define UDO. UDO is the Unified Development Ordinances, which were developed as a result of Charlotte City Council passing the 2040 Comprehensive Plan last year, which was really contentious. And the UDO codifies, if that's the word, codifies the aspirations in the 2040 plan. He, Malcolm Graham, is a supporter trying to wrap things up. He simply said, it's time to move on.
We voted on it last year. We had an election based on it last year. We got the results last year based on those elections, and now it's time for us to move forward.
Well, this isn't the first time this year that the council has taken a look at what they passed last year. They just recently decided that drive-throughs may not be the bad guy after all. And in areas like Noda and Elizabeth, they allowed one to be created there. So is this going back to committee? What's the situation on this?
Yeah, it's going to committee, but really nobody knows what the heck is going to happen or what is going to be presented in committee. I don't think all the people who voted for this would necessarily vote for a significant change to the UDO. I know Councilman Ed Driggs kind of alluded to that, saying, hey, I fought tooth and nail against this, but it passed. Now we got to move forward. And then on the other side, I don't know if everyone who voted no would vote no again either, but city staffers are quite frankly trying to figure out what the motion meant and what they can present to committee on June 5th. But any significant changes to the UDO will take a full council vote and the public will have a chance to weigh in.
A couple of weeks ago, and we talked about it on this program, it was revealed that BMOC Capital out of Charleston, South Carolina, had proposed to city council and Mecklenburg County Commission a major tennis facility in the River District that would include the relocation of the Western and Southern Tennis Tournament to Charlotte. Jenna, remind us of what that project consists of.
Yeah, so that project would, like you said, bring the Western and Southern Open from Cincinnati to Charlotte. If the developers were to choose Charlotte and get that public funding secured from the city, county, and state. But I believe, I'm trying to pull it up in front of me, but about 40 tennis courts, I think, a huge stadium, but they really see it bringing a huge economic impact. I mean, it's just a step underneath these Grand Slam titles in tennis
Yeah, they're asking for $60 to $70 million in from the city's hospitality fund to support this for a $400 million project that could have a $275 million annual economic impact, bringing 350,000 people to Charlotte, and give us international attention. Of course, City Councilman Malcolm Graham is a former tennis player. He called this an ace, and this is ours to say no to, he said. But according to Tracy Dotson, the city's economic development director, the clock is ticking.
If they don't get some kind of indication coming soon that there's that support, they need to shift and focus on Cincinnati.
That is where the tournament that they're trying to snag is currently being played. This appears to be something that could hold on to its luster for a long time. We always like to have shiny baubles in town, but this one may remain shiny for a while. What's the timetable, and are officials likely to say yes to this? Anybody know?
I think June is when they are hoping to have a final vote on it, and it certainly seems like they are ready to say yes. But remember, the county has to get involved too, and they haven't had any significant public discussions of this yet.
Two stories from CATS this week. First came news of their putting their chief of rail operations on administrative leave. Why?
Well, this is the fourth big-name CATS official we know that we've seen leave the agency in, I believe, less than a year, or in the last year. But we do not know why, but we know what kind of led up to this. We had a derailment last May, about almost a year to the date, that was not disclosed to the public. And this Delton Harris, he was the general manager of rail operations. A man named Terry Creech was fired for the derailment, and Delton Harris signed this guy's resignation letter. And now this guy is suing the city for wrongful termination. So we kind of have this pending litigation going on that CATS is not talking about or saying why. So it's unknown, but you can kind of draw conclusions from this. CATS has had a lot of issues leading up to this.
Yeah, and WBTV reported on this individual, Delton Harris, and found a report from his last job that identifies a series of major ongoing issues, such as, Nick?
Such as him ordering people to at his last job, where he worked for WMATA and the Metro Rail system up in D.C., ordering them to disobey safety protocols and operate trains anyways in ways that are counter to their safety protocols. This was an in-depth audit of their rail operations in D.C. And again, he left that job and came here to CATS.
The other story has to do with the driver of a bus on which shots were fired recently. Allegedly, during an argument, a passenger fired a shot at the driver, who then pulled his own gun and fired back. Both were hospitalized with life-threatening injuries. Both are now in stable condition and are expected to recover. The passenger was charged and banned from any CATS vehicles forever. But now the CATS has fired the driver of that bus. Interim CEO Brent Cagle says it's never okay for passengers to assault drivers or to threaten them, but it remains unclear if the driver will actually be charged.
Do I think the driver handled this appropriately? I understand everyone's need to protect themselves. I also believe that this incident may have been avoided had there been other actions, you know, ahead of this, ahead of the gunfire.
This is the fourth known incident like this involving CATS buses, drivers, or passengers. What security precautions are now in place? What additional measures are being taken or considered?
Yeah, so CATS is implementing a lot more de-escalation training. My understanding from Cagle was that before it was kind of bus operators had this de-escalation training to get the job, and then it was, you never had it again. Now they're implementing ongoing training, you know, maybe once a year, a couple times a year, something like that. The budget includes millions of dollars for new security cameras. They're expanding their bus ambassador program, which would add another CATS employee onto the bus that's trained in that de-escalation and customer service. So if someone doesn't want to pay a fare and starts an argument, or someone wants to get off the bus, like we just saw with that shooting last week, someone is trained to handle that. But we've also heard, and this is not coming from Katz, but I spoke with City Councilman Ed Driggs, who said, well, do we need to have metal detectors for the operators to walk through to make sure they don't have a gun on the bus? Because drivers aren't even allowed to have cell phones with them, let alone a gun.
Hmm. But there are alarm systems on the bus, a silent alarm.
And the driver did not press either of the silent alarms that were required. Okay. He did not follow proper de-escalation training.
And Joe, finally, you turned me on to this story because you just wanted me to say Sweepy McSweepface. Sweepy McSweepface. I said it again. That's one of three names for the city of Charlotte's new bike lane electric street sweepers. The other two were Cleopatra and Sweep Caroline. I was going to vote for the last, but everyone encouraged me to vote for the name before they announced last night. They said, pick one. I picked that one. What did they pick, Joe?
The winner was Sweepy McSweepface, and let's hope it does not have as many issues as Katz, so the city doesn't have to put out a press release saying Sweepy McSweepface is in it.
Joe Bruno, Nick Oxner, Gina Contino, and Shamaria Morrison, thank you all.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.